And I want to thank Senator Courtney for sitting in and giving us a forum here this afternoon. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 800. And Senator Nelson is here to introduce the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Nelson. I'm a state senator from, I live in Pendleton. I represent four counties in eastern Oregon, Wallala, Union, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. And I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 800. You'll have dash one amendments in front of you. The dash ones actually replace the whole bill. This has been a cooperative effort, really. We started this one over at dinner also, Mr. Chair. We were at a dinner with Dr. Peter Kohler at OHSU, and he was saying, well, you know, there's going to be a huge nursing shortage in this state. I think you guys down there in legislature ought to do something about it. So I've got to invite Senator Ryan Decker to the next dinner. I can see that. And Senator Courtney, too, for that.
Fellow members of the committee, Senator Nelson has dinner and introduces bills. This is the second one in 2 days, so we all need to go to dinner with that.
Anyway, we try to get work done, you know, in a nice, pleasant atmosphere. But this bill, and Representative Anderson has just done a marvelous job. She's a registered nurse. I have to give credit to my wife, Alice, who's legislative administrator. She's also a registered nurse. It's one of the times of my life where I figured out I didn't know anything about this bill. I was going to step away, and they took care of it. They got interest groups, and you'll hear a lot of testimony today from a great many people concerning the agreement they've come to. But I think if you look through the dash ones, which does replace the bill, as I said, the biggest thing you have to notice is shortages. If you look at the first three or four paragraphs, acute shortage of nurses, Oregon faces profound nursing shortage, whereas the shortage creates significant strains on health care. That's what this thing is all about. You know, we're trying to look to the future. We need to address this. We understand we're in a serious budget problem. You'll see in Section 7 of the amended bill that we have put in a $1 figure to go to Ways and Means. We understand the circumstance that we're in. What we're trying to do here is create the framework to put this process in place. The committee and the interested parties are trying to locate dollars. Yesterday, I wasn't in front of this committee. Yesterday at 852, Senate Bill 852, potentially using some of the MUPL money that's coming out that would be dedicated towards funding this program. That would be a statewide issue, and I think that, you know, goes to health care, and I think is possible. I don't know what Ways and Means will do with that, but we're really, you know, we're looking at areas that we can do that. If you look at it from an individual basis, the patient care, it's access to health care. And, you know, you need nurses in order to make this health care proceed and to work. If you look at it from a community basis, in our part of the country, and particularly the health care system is infrastructure, is economic development. Some of our biggest employers in our part of the country are in the healthcare industry. And so we're looking at a two-pronged thing, individuals and also from the community. What this bill does, it puts a structure in place. And we just think it's a necessary item. What we're asking you to do is to accept the dash one amendments, and it'll be sent to Ways and Means, as I understand, to keep the process moving. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Anderson. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Nelson, and committee members. I'm Lori Monis Anderson, a state representative from Gresham. And as Senator Nelson has already said, Oregon has a critical nursing shortage, and Senate Bill 800 addresses this issue. Oregon already has the goal of wanting to double its nursing graduates or enrollment actually by 2004, and this is really a lofty goal, and nursing programs right now are trying to figure out how to do this. The legislature really needs to support this effort. Remember, this really is a workforce issue. The more nurses that we have graduated and filling all of these empty positions that we have throughout the state, they pay high wages, and they will be offering good income taxes back to the state of Oregon. So we have to remember that also. besides helping the economy, this bill is also going to improve health care of Oregonians. The nursing shortage really affects the quality of all Oregonians' health care and their access to that care. This shortage has really created a significant strain on our system at a time when more and more of us are getting to that age where we're really going to need more health care services. Senate Bill 800 actually will award grants to institutions that will expand the capacity of our nursing education programs. And there's a variety of ways that we can do this. And hopefully the focus is going to be on either developing regional learning laboratories, providing technical support to nursing education, creating learning materials, utilizing distance learning technology. But besides awarding grants, this bill creates also, it's called the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee. There have been a number of organizations that have been meeting since the beginning of this session. Senator Nelson, actually Mrs. Nelson, and I have coordinated these members. It's a group that have actually been meeting for 2 or 3 years, most of them, not all of them. So we have gotten all sides together. We've gotten OHSU to the table. We've gotten Oregon Nurses Association to the table. We've gotten the university, I'm speaking too loud. We've gotten the universities, the private universities who have nursing training programs at the table. We have the hospitals at the table. We have, I believe, AFL-CIO was at the table. We have had a number of different organizations working on this bill, and this is why we've actually come up with the amendment, because we had the first draft, thought it was okay, and then everyone thought it would be better this way. And we've also had the governor's office at the table also giving us their views. So we've worked really hard, and already we are increasing the collaboration between public and private agencies, and I think this is critical to helping solve this nursing shortage problem. So thank you so much for hearing this bill, and as a registered nurse, I know how important Senate Bill 800 is going to be to the state of Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? I think we'll go to the last year. Teleconference.
Dr. Creighton. Sure. Chairperson Starr, members of the committee, this is Phil Creighton. I'm president of Eastern Oregon University. And Senator Decker, would you like to have dinner tomorrow night?
I'll be there.
It's a pleasure to be here speaking to you from the Grand today, as I was speaking in front of the committee yesterday in Salem. And it shows you how technology can provide the bridge for many of these activities. We're here in speaking in favor of Senate Bill 800 and to talk to you about a very personal story of how this relates to the nurses and to the region of Eastern Oregon. We have a very wonderful relationship that's extended back over 20 years with Oregon Health Sciences University. This relationship has allowed us to graduate about 32 students a year. Now I want to put another spin on this. A statistic which is dramatic to us is that 70% of our students stay within a 200-mile radius of campus when they graduate. That includes the graduates of the nursing program as well. That is significant because in many ways, the only way that John Day and some of the other small communities in Eastern Oregon could get nurses is by having them have ability to take that training at sites that are convenient to them. We have been a pioneer in what we call the Frontier Rural Delivery System. This system provides training for nurses at sites and at homes and at communities close to where they live. This Frontier Rural Delivery, or Rural Frontier Delivery, provides education services to the people when they need them at sites where it's convenient to them. What Senate Bill 800 will do for us is to allow greater access and greater expansion to this. We've been working very, very diligently to try to create a partnership with the hospitals, with the federal government, and with EOU and OHSU through some of our rural frontier delivery efforts. For example, we received $250,000 as an earmark from the federal government to help place educational services at communities across rural Oregon. We've worked with the hospitals to help provide tuition benefits for their nurses in exchange for extended service, a promise of extended service after they graduate. We've worked with local communities to help with placement of the nurses into practical situations where their benefits of nurse caring can be directly felt by the population. This situation we enjoy with OHSU and EOU is certainly a national model of how two institutions can collaborate to provide much-needed services to areas without the service, very honestly, would not have nurses available to the communities. Senate Bill 800 basically expands those opportunities for us to increase this collaboration, to expand our efforts to provide nurse training to rural Oregon. We have one of the benefits of working with so many wonderful students is I have one of the students beside me today. Her name is Karen Westmoreland. She is a graduate from the Rural Frontier Delivery Program and is currently in John Day. I'm very pleased, Mr. Chairman, to introduce to you Karen Westmoreland. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have for me.
Chairman, Chair Starr and members of the committee, my name is Karen Westmoreland and I live in John Day, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 800. I will complete my nursing education via the Rural Frontier Delivery Program in June of this year. I have done the entire program out of John Day and will return to or will work in John Day when I graduate. I've got a job at the hospital there locally. I think that this program is invaluable to me and my family. I've been able to stay where we have established our home and raise a family. And also, when I'm done with the program, we'll be able to give back to my community by working in a rural area. And I believe John Day is a Frontier One critical shortage area for nurses.
You could ask me if there's any questions.
Are there any questions for anything that I've done or have said?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify by distance education to the committee, and I certainly encourage your consideration of SB 800. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have several folks signed up, and I don't see any opposition to this. We'd pray that you'd keep your testimony brief. You all have written testimony to hand in, I believe. So we're going to start with a group, Kathy Latima, Chris Tanner, Erwin Hauer,
David Bybee, and
David Bybee. I don't know if we can find another chair loose that we can bring up, fourth chair. Perhaps not.
They're not loose.
They're not loose.
No one wants to see me wrestle them today either.
Okay. Please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Kathleen Patempa. I'm the Vice President and Dean of OHSU School of Nursing, and I do have a few colleagues and students here. We will be brief, but we want to provide some important information that is supportive to this Senate Bill 800 as it is amended. It's been well documented in landmark publications, including the Northwest Health Foundation study, as well as the U.S. Health and Human Services report, that Oregon is in the midst of a severe and growing nurse shortage. While this shortage encompasses so many areas, you can see from our written testimony that virtually every sector of health care is considerably hard hit. Hospitals and critical care and specialty units, long-term care agencies, public health departments, rural area hospitals are especially hard hit, and indeed schools of nursing. Dr. Chris Tanner, who is at my left and to will speak about the dramatic statistics. She was the principal investigator on the Northwest Health Foundation-funded study, which really documented for the state the significance and severity of the shortage. This unprecedented shortage of nurses, both nationally and in Oregon, comes at a time of a growing depletion of nursing faculty as well. This shortage is spurred by retirements as well as disincentives such as low salaries for academic careers. Both the Northwest Health Foundation and the DHHS report suggest that the faculty shortage even outpaces some of this shortage of nurses and is a significant barrier to the workforce. We at Oregon Health and Science University, with our four campuses, and I do have a color visual there for you, we have several sites around the state. We understand the needs of both rural and urban communities. We have heard from many hospitals, public health, and long-term care agencies in the regions which we serve. You will hear from Dr. Tanner about the many, many, many qualified applicants who we are unable to accept into our programs around the state. While OHSU presently educates one quarter of all the nurses produced in the state of Oregon, we have hundreds of qualified applicants who we are unable to accommodate. So despite this crying need for nurses, and despite the outstanding applicant pool, why are we unable to expand to meet our ONLC objectives? The significant factors limiting our ability to enroll students are financial resources to hire the faculty to teach and to purchase the equipment, materials, and supplies needed for their practice laboratory experiences. Additionally, the faculty shortage is looming. Senate Bill 800, as amended, provides a necessary grant mechanism that will leverage the partnerships among educational institutions that will promote creative and community-based solutions in resource sharing that will allow us to expand both our basic nursing programs as well as graduate programs that prepare future faculty. You will also hear from two of our students. One has come from as far away as Lakeview. They will give compelling testimony for what this educational opportunity has meant to them and are just a small illustration of the hundreds of students waiting in line behind them. Every nurse that is educated is a citizen who has opportunity for enriching and predictable work. As Representative Lori Mons Anderson said, investing in nursing education makes good sense for the health of Oregonians and for the economy of the state. Thank you, and I will turn this over now to Dr. Tanner.
Thank you. I also will try to be very brief, knowing that you have a very full agenda, I see, from today. Briefly stated, we expect by 2020 to have 16,000 fewer nurses than what will be needed.
Give us your name for the record.
I'm sorry. It's Christine Tanner. I'm a professor and director of the statewide undergraduate program at OHSU. 47% fewer nurses than what we need, 16,000 down. That's absolutely stunning, I think, from many perspectives. Recently, we've had several studies that have supported what we've known for a long time, and that's simply if there aren't enough nurses in hospital units, for example, more patients develop complications and more patients die. Simply stated, it's a huge public health crisis looming, the shortage that's upon us. It comes in large measure from the rapidly aging workforce and the increasing demands. We expect a large cohort of nurses to be retiring in the next 15 years, along with the rest of their boomer cohort. And that, coupled with this increasing demand, is what's creating the shortage. Now, I've just spent the last week reviewing over 700 applications for our undergraduate program, and it breaks my heart. We have 182 places. We have well over 530 qualified applicants for our campus of 730 applications. Here's a woman who we're turning just as an example. She writes in her essay, 41-year-old woman, bachelor's degree. She says, for several years, I owned and operated three adult foster care homes, where we provided a broad range of care to 15 dependent elderly clients. And I'll just summarize what she says. Basically, she loves the practice of caring for older people, and she's realized that she needs a nursing education to really bring her enthusiasm and compassion to that work, and that's what she wants to do. She's one of the 200 on our waiting list, more than 200, that probably will not be admitted. And yet we're facing this incredible shortage. So we believe that with a relatively small infusion of funding, granted the state's fiscal crisis now, that we can stem a huge, more costly healthcare crisis in the future. So I speak very much in support of Senate Bill 800 as it's amended. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Erin Auer. I'm a student at the Portland campus of Oregon Health Science University School of Nursing. I'm a member of the Southwest Community of Portland, and I'm here today to speak in favor of the Senate Bill 80 amended. Without repeating all she said, I just wanted to point out the fact that being a student coming from Oregon State University, I was a 3.7 grade point average student and was placed on the waiting list last year. I feel fortunate that I was taken off the waiting list and now a student at Oregon Health Science University, but I feel that I highlight the point that she just made, that they're very well-qualified students that aren't able to attend. As far as economically, I know just from looking at different job listings that I will have no problem getting a job once I graduate. I know that we've already been approached in our clinical sites by clinical nurse practitioners and specialists to see if we would return after graduation. Which is really good for students like me who pay their education with loans. I know I'll have no problem getting out and finding a stable job to repay my loans. In closing, nurses have traditionally been the link between community and healthcare, and I'm worried that in my own practice that I might not be able to fulfill that link because the facility I work for might not have enough nurses, and I might become more of a task-oriented nurse than a people-oriented nurse, and that is not the kind of nursing that I'm being taught at OHSU, nor do I believe in practicing. So for those reasons, I'm in support of Senate Bill 800. Thank you for your time.
My name is David Bybee. I'm a student nurse at the OIT campus through OHSU. I live in Lakeview. I worked for 25 years as a manager in a wood molding mill, and I was laid off, and I didn't have a college degree of any kind to fall back on. So, and there's not a lot of job opportunities in Lakeview. I was reading in the paper about the nursing shortage and the training that was available through the RFD program, and so I got my prerequisites through home study and online courses, and was anxious to get started in the RFD program, but as time came to apply to that, I found that through funding cuts, the RFD program had been cut, and so I wasn't able to apply to that in Lakeview. I was encouraged to apply at OIT, and I did so, and was excited to be able to get into the program. But because of the cut in the program, I now have an apartment in Klamath. My family lives in Lakeview, and it's costing me more to get my education because of the travel and extra housing costs. Talking to the hospital in Lakeview, they definitely have a shortage of nursing, and they have to nurses, and they have to fill some of their positions through traveling nurses. And they've already assured me that I'd have a position there in Lakeview. And not a lot of people want to move there, but those who of us who like living there, they're anxious to have someone that is wanting to live in Lakeview. This hasn't been easy. I have kids of my own in college, and when I graduate, I'll have a couple going in, and my youngest will be a senior in high school. I would hope that we would expand more programs, make it easier to achieve the dream of becoming a nurse, and open more pathways for a much-needed profession.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Compelling testimony. Again, I want to urge folks as they come up to, I don't have any opposition for this bill. We'd like to move it today. So let us get on with it. Chris O'Neill, Elizabeth Goulard.
Good afternoon, Senator Starr, members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Goulard, and I'm Vice President for Academic Services here at Chemeketa Community College in Salem. And I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Community College Association today. Community colleges do support this bill as amended because it brings a much-needed funding source to the nursing program capacity expansion efforts that are already underway at community colleges. And just a few high points. We are busy creating solutions as we speak. We're working with our university partners to better align curricula and define competencies for our grads so that students throughout the state can more easily move between and among programs and go from an associate degree to a baccalaureate degree and on to further education. And we've had great success in public-private partnerships to date to provide some funding for program expansion capacity. And our local healthcare partners have helped us in many instances. I've given you a couple of examples in the written testimony of hospitals and other partners who are stepping up to help provide funding for nursing faculty so that we can expand. That begins the process. This bill would help support additional expansion efforts. And we're also looking at ways to provide non-traditional training, and I've given you a couple of examples in the written testimony as well that would show you examples such as evening weekend program options, distance learning-based options, work we're doing through video conferencing and other arenas. We, too, have more qualified applicants for our program than we can admit. From early indicators, we have at least 130 students who will be vying for just over 60 spots in our program this spring, each one which has a very compelling story to tell. And I think you know that financial realities limit our ability to expand. This issue hits not just the nursing courses, but all, each and every one of the related course requirements in our programs for math, science, writing, anatomy, and physiology, microbiology. Our anatomy and physiology sections this year fill up within 10 minutes of the registration opening. So we have lots of funnels that are created for students. Which we would love to have help addressing. Just want to point out that healthcare programs are our highest cost per FTE programs. They'll range at a community college from about $5,000 to $15,000 per FTE, depending upon the particular program. We're looking today at, with the governor's proposed budget, at about a $1,900 per FTE reimbursement. So there's a gap. We need help with funding, and that funding can go to help the nursing shortage. So we are struggling to keep programs viable and to expand them at the same time. We're here. We're responding. We're ready to respond more readily and address this critical shortage, providing that the state can step up and add some investment to the partnerships that are already underway. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to add that I have a granddaughter who was part of your program for part of the last 2 years, and now a new mother, and moved to Corvallis, so I don't know whether we're going to get her to continue or not. Appreciate her opportunity there.
Good.
Thank you. Please.
Senator Starr, members of the committee, my name is Chris O'Neill. I'm a member of the board of directors of the Oregon Nurses Association, and today I am representing the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council as chair of the council, and we are pleased to support SB 800 and the amendments that will be introduced during this hearing. The members of the ONLC are the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, there's a hospital vice presidents for patient care, the Oregon Council of Associate Degree Programs, the Oregon Council of Deans, the Oregon Nurses Association, and the Oregon State Board of Nursing. These are the primary and key nurse interest groups collaborating on a single effort. We, too, have presented some statistical information that I will leap over. Over the last 3 years, the ONLC has developed and is implementing a plan, which is attached to these written comments, to address the nursing shortage. That plan incorporates both recruitment and retention goals and activities that are equally important to our ultimate success. The ONLC believes that both the state and federal government should play a role in solving the nursing shortage. We've identified some key criteria for any legislation that comes forward, and I'd like to underline those, that new legislation should expand nursing education capacity. It should increase cost efficiency. It should maintain standards, and it should be inclusive of all the interests of the nursing community. SB 800 meets the test in each and every case. SB 800 does two important things. First, it establishes a grant program whereby nursing programs are can participate in the development of infrastructure, preparation of additional nursing faculty members, creation of materials for new teaching and learning methodologies, and coordination of student clinical experiences. The program is expected to maximize resources by seeking matching funds from a variety of sources and is also expected to focus on increasing the diversity of individuals who enter the nursing profession, more closely matching Oregon's population. Second, the grant program will be directed by the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee, which will be composed of the very same organizations as represented in ONLC. The nursing community accepts the responsibility for leadership in solving this critical shortage, as demonstrated by our collaborative effort here, and believes that it is important for the major nursing organizations to continue to work together on this issue over time. I do want to add a verbal note to the written comments, and that is that regarding the appointment of members to the Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee. The ONLC would like the intent to be that both the independent colleges and universities that have nursing programs and the Community College Association appoint their members in collaboration with the nursing programs in those colleges. We think it's important to keep strong nursing voice involved in this. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
One quick question here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question just on Section 4 of the Dash 1 amendments, and you referenced this. I'm always reticent to create new task forces or new committees, but you would be the expert. Is there nothing that we have existing that could perform the function of adopting the criteria, distributing the grants, doing the work that the Dash 1s have this Oregon Nursing Shortage Coalition Committee is charged to do?
Well, you know, in all honesty, I don't know the answer to that. I've never done an audit of all the possible. What I can say is this, that the organizations that we're recommending are the very people that have been working consistently over the years to address this issue effectively. They are the right people to do the work. So whatever the structure is that we may call it, if it exists anywhere at all at the moment, it's definitely an Oregon Nurse Leadership Council. And I am as reticent as you are to add new bureaucracy of any kind at all that makes it harder to get work done. I think this group gets work done. And that's why we're here today supporting one measure, together this year. Does that help?
You don't see this, Mr. Chair, that committee is in any way duplicative. You see them as unique and necessary to fulfill that.
Absolutely, because it does include clinical dimensions, and you need clinical experts in the room. You need education experts, and the folks involved so far have demonstrated their willingness to collaborate with one another and, you know, to give and take as time goes on. That's who I'd stick with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Very good question. Dave Fiskum, Kathy Johnson, Joe Bell.
I didn't. That's important. That's more important.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiska. I'm here representing Providence Health System. I'm tempted, in light of your admonition for brevity, to provide forward testimony, which is good bill should pass.
work.
But, right, I suspect that it might, Mr. Chair, in light of what you had said several times. We will be very brief today, and I will consider it to be my role to make just a very brief introduction and then make sure you are introduced to Kathy Johnson, to my left, your right, who is the nurse executive for Providence Health System for the Oregon region. We're here in support of the principles embodied in Senate Bill 800. We have read the -1 amendments just today, and we would be fine with those. That's why I say principles. Be aware that Providence Health System is a very large health system today. In fact, Oregon's largest, also the second largest private employer. We operate 7 hospitals in communities throughout the state in both urban and rural Oregon. And we have a strong and continuing interest, as Kathy will describe to you better than I can, in the profession of nursing and any initiative that will foster the education of more nurses in this state. And it's with that in mind that we're very pleased to be here today to have this kind of discussion with you. And we'll endeavor, as I say, to be brief. And, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to turn to Kathy to make the bulk of our remarks from Providence's standpoint.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm really happy to be here to thank you for considering this bill and to congratulate you for considering this bill. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time. The sponsors of Senate Bill 800 asked me to describe an innovative program that Providence undertook some time ago to train or to educate more nurses, and that program is known as the Providence Scholar Program. We undertook this effort as a means of quickly and aggressively resolving our future, understanding that we could not and should not look to government alone for a comprehensive solution. Nonetheless, I think there is a role for government to play in this solution. As you've heard over the past months since 9/11, there's not a problem recruiting people to the profession of nursing, but many, many qualified people are being turned away for two reasons. There are either not enough clinical sites for the schools to place their students, or there are not enough clinical instructors or instructors to accept the students. And thirdly, it's always useful to provide some assistance with the tuition these days so that people can afford to get through the program. The Providence Scholar Program addressed all three of those key elements by guaranteeing all of our hospitals as clinical sites for students at the university, by releasing our bachelor's and master's prepared staff and management nurses to assist in teaching and supervising the students when they're at our facilities on their clinical rotations. And because we were able to do that, the university has been able to double its enrollment in the junior year from 70 to 150 students. So we think that it's working. The Scholars Program is designed to provide 75 full tuition scholarships each year for juniors and seniors. And in return, when they graduate, they will work for us for 3 years. Providence's initial commitment is $2.5 million a year, making this the nation's largest commitment to this type of program. I don't know whether the program will be a model for others. I believe, though, that it's worthy of consideration as a step in providing more qualified nurses to work in our facilities and other facilities through the state.
Question? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jill Bell, and I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm actually here today not only representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, but the Northwest Organization of Nurse Executives, which are the nursing executives for the hospitals. You have received written testimony from Nancy Connell, who is the president-elect of Northwest One, and I will only say that she is very excited about Senate Bill 800 and hopes that you will pass it. She feels that it will be a stimulus, as we do, to all of the good work that's already going on in the state and all the innovative programs that are already being developed and put forward by hospitals, community colleges, long-term care. Everyone involved in the issue are working very diligently, and this will be just a good stimulation and an acknowledgement of that work as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just in conclusion, I wanted to applaud Representative Montes Anderson as well as Senator Nelson for bringing this bill forward. We're ready to work the bill in Ways and Means if you send it there, as well as on the House side, and if Providence or OAHHS can provide assistance to you and your colleagues along the way in crafting the final bill, we'll be pleased to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Final two witnesses, Gary M. Dean. Oh, I guess I got three more. Brenda Smith and Paula, and I can't read the last name.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr, Gary Ann Dean, Oregon Independent College Association Executive Director. Dave Fiscom just offered to try to do it in four words. I'll try to do it in just three sentences. First, the independent sector of higher education in Oregon represents a huge private investment in the nursing shortage issues in this state over many, many decades with the two programs at Linfield College and at University of Portland. Second, over 40% of the four-year nursing degrees awarded in this state come from those two institutions. And third, we want to thank and commend the sponsors of this legislation for including the private sector in a search for the solution to this problem. Thank you.
Senator Starr, Chair, and committee members, I'm Brenda Smith. I'm the Dean of Nursing at Linfield College, one of the members of the Oregon Independent Nurses, Independent, not Nurses Association, Independent Colleges. Anyway, thank you for this opportunity to be here today, and I just simply want to say that we're very much in favor of the bill. It is important to us, of course, that private colleges be included in the funding that comes out of this. I graduated 118 students last year and 120 this year, and so as Gary has said, we turn out quite a number, and the majority of our students graduate in 2 years, so we can get them out pretty fast, and we need a little help in gearing up to do it and do more.
My name is Paula Gubrud-Howe, and I'm the Nursing Program Director at Mount Hood Community College in Gresham, and I'm here to speak on behalf of Associate Degree Nursing Directors. I'll tell you a little bit about Mount Hood's program, which is pretty typical of all of the 14 Associate Degree Nursing Programs here in the state. We serve a special kind of student, a large, diverse group. Some are right out of high school, and some are second career. Some are returning to the workforce after having raised a family. Often the associate degree program serves the underserved in our community, folks that haven't had a lot of social economic privilege, and we're able to provide a good education that leads to family wage jobs and access to even higher education after the community college experience. We do a great job of preparing well-prepared nurses throughout the state, especially in the rural areas. There's many areas in Oregon where the healthcare systems are very dependent on the nurses that community colleges are preparing at this time. I have a story, too, about the number of applicants versus the number of positions that I'll be offering. I sent out 3,600 applications this year. I have 309 qualified applications, and I will be able to accept 48 for the fall. I took started a tally on Monday as far as the number of contacts that I've had this week for people who are interested in our nursing program, and between Monday and Wednesday had 46 inquiries into the program. So there's clearly a significant need. We just lack the funding to increase capacity. So I appreciate your time and effort and hope you'll pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, we're going to... Was anyone else needing to testify on the bill? I don't have anyone else signed up. We're going to close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 800. The chair would entertain a motion to move the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
It's Senator Decker.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 800.
Senator Decker has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 800. Any discussion? Any objections? Not so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Decker.
I move Senate Bill 800 as amended to our Committee on Ways and Means with a due fund recommendation.
Senator Decker has moved Senate Bill 800 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due fund recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Fairley. Senator Morissette. Vice Chair Decker.
Aye.
Chair Starr. Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. Senate Bill 800 moved to Ways and Means. With that, I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 761. I need a sign-up sheet. And I have a recommended order here.
Where
is this phone? Did you get a hold of me?
I called and said you were, it would be 5 minutes.
You can meet as a subcommittee. Oh, if you have to, you can go in and meet as a subcommittee because I may have to leave to see about it. If you have to, I'm not getting my work this day. All right, it's up to you. If you're called.
We're going to if we get Senator Deckard here.
I need to go. I got probably 50 more.
Okay. Well, we can have the hearing today.
Right.
I was waiting for Senator Starr to get here to introduce his bill. He has arrived, and with that, Senator Bruce Starr.
Thank you very much, Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, I am Bruce Starr, State Senator and represent District 15. I am the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 761 and a strong advocate of home education. In introducing this bill, I'm going to give a synopsis of why this bill should be adopted, and then each point that I cover will be expounded in greater detail by others that will be testifying before you today. First off, children who are home educated outperform their public and private school counterparts. Regulation does not affect the quality level of education, as Dr. Brian Ray will point out. Among other reasons, home education works because it is highly tailored and individualized, custom fit for each child with high levels of parental involvement. Parents need the freedom to choose the most appropriate way to assess their children. The tests that homeschoolers take are standardized tests. Standardized tests cannot and do not adequately determine how well a child is being educated, since they are receiving made-to-order education. Senate Bill 761 gives home educators the same freedom to choose how to assess their students as private schools have. Currently, private schools are not required to take any tests. Another incentive to adopt this bill is that it will free up roughly $500,000 annually that the state currently spends monitoring home-educated children in the state. This bill would allow those public education dollars to be spent on our public schools, not on supervising home educators. Lastly, Oregon is not blindly stepping into dangerous and uncharted territory with this bill. Over 40% of the states in this nation have chosen not to require any substantive oversight of homeschoolers. In closing, I urge you to adopt the bill. I would like it noted that in order to respect your time, those who are testifying in support of this bill are making a concerted effort to keep their testimonies quick and succinct. Thank you for your time. I would now like to turn the testimony over to three young men who have been home educated. I'd like to share their experiences with you. In addition to that, that testimony reading into the record, I'd just like to make note that we've gone through a process in the state of Oregon, a process whereby a few short years ago, home educators were highly regulated in the state, required to test their children every year, and the ESDs were required to look at those tests, and the data showed, the data demonstrated, those test results indicated that homeschoolers were doing a tremendous job, and their parents were doing a tremendous job, and the home-educated kids in this state were doing a tremendous job. And just a few sessions ago, I believe 1999, we did relax the standards, the requirements on homeschoolers because of the great track record that they had accumulated, a track record of success, a track record of excellence. And I think it is time again to readdress and look again at the regulations that we have as a state on this homeschooling population. I think this is the next logical step. We've got a record. We've got a record of excellence. And I'd urge this committee to adopt this bill, move it to the Senate floor where we can have a full debate among the Senate on this issue. I'd like to thank the very many citizens that have turned out today to support this bill. And I appreciate all of them taking the effort to come. And again, I'd, if there's questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But if not, I'd like to turn the dais over to the next three that I think have been coordinated to help provide testimony on the bill.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I have some questions.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Ferriero, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I think the Senator Starr and both Senator Starrs are be congratulated for constant support, unwavering support for homeschooling in Oregon. I dare say that we might not have homeschooling as we know it today without the work of the good chairman and former representative, now Senator Starr. And I've been a supporter of homeschooling. The issue has not always been an easy one. Matter of fact, it's never been an easy one. And there's been quite a bit of controversy around the whole concept of homeschooling, and not a little bit of resistance from the educational institutions that we also cherish, the education community has been skeptical, to say the least. And I think that skepticality is healthy because it's caused homeschoolers to reach a very high bar, and very quickly. And so I am curious about good Senator Starr the Younger's attitude or take on the idea that part of what made the progress so rapid in relative terms to get to the place that we are in homeschooling was the fact that homeschoolers tested and compared very favorably with our public education testing, and that they continue to test high. And that, in fact, is the record that gives citizens and policymakers like myself confidence that homeschooling is a viable alternative. Why in the world, if that testing requirement was what led us to be able to convince the skeptics that this was a viable and good option in Oregon, why would we now turn away from the thing that essentially is the foundation that we can turn to prove that homeschooling is efficient and efficacious and of benefit to kids in school?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli. Clearly, that has been kind of the foundation, the basis from which we've been able to make these judgments. And I think, too, as you look at the changes that were made in 1999 session, without having the original homeschool legislation was passed in the late 80s, perhaps. So you had about a decade of experience. Because of that decade of experience, the changes that we made in 1999 were supported, actually, by the OSBA and COSA, and ultimately the governor signed the bill. And I think that was because we had that record. as we move from here, you know, here forward, it's not as if we're not going to still be able to have good information about how homeschoolers are performing, because these home educated, and you'll hear from many of them today, aren't just going from graduating from homeschool and then not going on to higher education and not going on to pursue other things. My sense is that we will have SAT, records as it relates to SAT scores. We'll have records as it opposed to other testing mechanisms as kids move into higher education. I think we will continue to be able to get good data about how homeschoolers are performing. And I think that historically we will again be able to track how well they're doing. These kids, these families are dedicated. They're working hard. They're wanting to provide solid, well-rounded and good foundations for their children's future, and that's not going to end just because if the state were to permit them, no longer require them to take tests.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I appreciate your answer, Senator. That helps put it into perspective. The other issue for me is that one of the greatest concerns about homeschooling is that no matter what the motivation of the parent or the family to provide homeschooling, and they're as varied as parents are, as people are, the overriding public policy concern is that kids get a good education and they get prepared for success in life. And that's sort of where the private parental prerogative and the public policy imperative collide. You know, it's not only the parents' responsibility to make sure kids get prepared. It's public policymakers, and in fact, mine and yours. That's the duty part of this job. How will I assure myself and others that in fact those kids are getting prepared unless they do the test? You know, and let me just ramble on just another second, Mr. Chairman. My kids hate tests. We agonize over those things. I remember, every year of every academic quarter, every class, my kids just don't like tests, and they agonize over them. The parents agonize. We wring our hands over them, and it is a big deal, and it's no less a big deal for parents. And the homeschooler parents have to pay for the testing, and it is time-consuming. But in fact, it is the yardstick by which we measure success of the kids, not only to satisfy critics of the system, but just to benchmark the kids' progress. So how are we going to do that if we don't do this testing?
Well, clearly we lose that opportunity for a kind of a constant measure if we go this direction, without question. But I would point directly to what we require in our public school, our private schools today. We don't. We don't have any idea that kids that go to a private school are learning anything, because we don't have any way of tracking that. And what we do have here is we have a track record of unparalleled success and excellence. And so do we potentially lose something by not being able to know for sure that every one of these kids all along the way is progressing appropriately? We do, and it's hard to say otherwise. And maybe if folks that follow my testimony have some other good ideas, I'd be open to listening to those as well about how will we know. But as you look at how we treat kids today, and there's tens of thousands of them that are in private schools, we go on faith that the private, the parent who's sending their kid to a private school isn't going to do that and expect that their child is not going to learn. I don't think we would expect anything less from a parent who's basically pouring their life into their children through home education would expect anything less. And we as a state should recognize, in my opinion, recognize the value, the importance of a parent that, in my estimation, sacrifices their life for their children by teaching them at home. Why would we expect anything less than from that parent than a parent that sends their children to a private school.
Mr. Chairman, I think those are thoughtful, excellent responses. Thank you.
Let me add to that a little bit. I just got in the mail a stack of papers in a big manila envelope from a homeschool student, 16 years old, who has completed courses in higher mathematics. And the papers that I got in the mail were a series of 10 tests that she had taken as a part of her homeschool instruction and proof of accomplishment. This homeschool student, this 16-year-old granddaughter of mine who's on the mission field in Mexico, and she is doing extremely well. She has the advantage of a father who is graduating in the top 5% of his class in electrical engineering and so is able to teach her science and math. But it's very obvious that not only are they being taught, they're being tested to see that they're learning what they are being taught. So I thank you for the question. Bring up those three young people.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Tanner Howell and Brian Knopf.
Yes.
Yes.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before you today. For the record, my name is Tanner Howell. I'm 24 years old. And I live in Gresham, Oregon. I'm a fan of baseball and opera. During my grade school years, my parents trained me in such areas as mathematics, writing, science, history, economics, and biblical doctrine. During my high school years, I also excelled in drama, singing, and teaching. My father introduced me to business, and I began apprenticing in the trade I still enjoy today. I began my own business, I began my own auto repair business just over 2 years ago, and have had the privilege to train five others to be productive. As our business grows, we are looking to create even more jobs. I'm even proud to have repaired a dent in Senator Bev Clarino's car last month. Feather in the cap. I am thankful to my parents for teaching me to serve well. In December of 2001, I was married to Noelle Payne, a longtime friend. We intend to home educate our children and would like the freedom to train them in the way we feel they should go without the interference of tests that we feel are unnecessary for our children. I encourage you to vote for SB 761. This bill will give greater freedom to us and to other home educators while we pursue an individualized education for each of our children. Thank you. Do you have any questions for me?
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Starr, members. One day when I was 6 years old, my mom made me walk.
Name for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Brian Knopf. One day when I was 6 years old, my mom made me walk out the front door, around the block, and back in the back door where she greeted me. Welcome to your first day of school. My name is Brian Knopf. I'm a native Oregonian. I was born in Klamath Falls and raised in Portland, a real-life homeschooler. Of all the things that my parents did right, chief among them was their ability to help me discover my interests and how to best pursue them. I was given an excellent education in the basics, reading, writing, and math, as well as arts and sciences. To someone looking in, my education might have looked like a crazy maze of started projects and rabbit trails of random interests. However, the reality is it was the most custom-made curriculum ever written. When I reached my freshman year of high school, we had to make a decision. Would I move on to public school, or would we continue my home-based education? My parents made it clear that they would support my decision if I wanted to go to public school. The high school I was interested in was Benson. They boasted a radio station as well as music and a technical program that closely matched my own interests. After careful consideration, I decided I would have a more diverse education and greater opportunities if I continued my self-study. With my parents' support, we decided to continue my education outside of the traditional school. In those 4 years, my own music program culminated in my taking second place in a state piano competition, as well as playing violin with the Portland State University Orchestra and a junior program with the Oregon Symphony. I also had the opportunity to work as an assistant engineer at a recording studio in Seattle. I spent the last 2 years of high school on the road as an audio engineer, with all my travel and living expenses paid, doing my schoolwork in hotel rooms with my laptop and an internet connection. I literally got to see the world while getting paid to do it, traveling as far as Australia. Could you ask for a better high school job?
My life after high school is turning out to be just as successful and just as much fun. I'm currently employed at the law firm Davis Wright Tremaine as a network administrator while attending Portland Community College, where I maintain a GPA of 3.75. I got married last June, and my wife and I are purchasing our first home on Friday. I do not believe that any of this would have been possible if not for two things. First, parents that cared enough to invest that much time and energy into my education. And second, the privilege of living in a state that believes in educational choices and opportunities for its youth. These values would only be encouraged by passing SB 761. I urge you to unanimously give a due pass recommendation. Status quo only restricts private educational freedom. I respectfully urge you to pass it.
Any questions?
You got a question?
Yes, thank you,
Senator Perioli.
Mr. Chairman, I absolutely believe that these two gentlemen have no difficulty in passing standardized examinations. If you are in fact representative of homeschoolers, and I think you might be, why the reluctance to do the tests?
Chair Starr, Senator Perioli, my opinion. It was my parents' responsibility to educate me, and not the state's. I'm not particularly of the opinion that the tests would harm me, but that it is not the government's job to train me and educate me. When I have children, I would like to train them myself. I believe that I have a greater love for my children than anyone else ever could. And with all due respect, including anyone at the state level. I do understand the necessity of public schools. I do understand it is some parents' choice to have people that they feel are more qualified train their children than themselves in the basic education, in the area of basic education. But I also believe that those of us who would like to train our own children and would like to do it at home and make that step, we'll do a good job, or else we'll make the choice to have the public education system train them.
Thank you very much. We have Ryan Ray. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Starr, Ferrioli, Deckert, Morissette, thank you for giving me some time. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 761. My name is Brian D. Ray, R-A-Y. I'll try to slip over the things real fast that become fairly obvious. First of all, I should say I do more research on homeschooling than probably anybody in the world. I get to spend all day on it. So I've been doing this for about 19 years. The home educators in Oregon and across the nation have consistently shown remarkable successes in academics, areas of social-emotional development, civic engagement, and just about any other measure that researchers across America, United Kingdom, Australia, including myself, have found in every study we've done, basically. For example, they score on average 15 to 30 percentile points above the public school average hundreds of times in all kinds of studies. And the successes continue into adulthood. Now, at some point here, I'll feel like I'm mainly addressing Senator Ferrioli's question, so I think I'll be able to deal with that fairly well, I hope. Research on institutional schools and their students, for example, public schools, consistently show that one of the most important elements in their success is parental involvement. And educators know that far and wide. I've been a public school teacher in Oregon, private school teacher, professor of education at the undergraduate and graduate levels, both in Oregon, Seattle Pacific University, and so forth. And so I teach teachers both in-service and pre-service. And we know that parental involvement is a key. And homeschooling, in essence, is the epitome of parental involvement. Whether the parent might be the most qualified or least qualified, certified teacher or not, college graduate or not, making low income, high income, medium income, doesn't seem to matter when we look at the statistics and control for background variables in the research on homeschooling. There's not much of a connection as there is in public schools. In other words, in public schools, high income or high education level parent children do well in public schools, low income, low educational attainment, poorly. Minorities do worse in public schools except for Asians. White Anglos do better, and so forth and so on. It just happens over and over and over again. And we find that basically that's not the case in homeschooling. Now, here's a key that I would like to deal with in terms of this question of testing. For example, if the homeschoolers do well in testing, why would they not want to do it? Or a question was asked here, Senator, one of the senators asked, well, if testing was in some ways a foundation or somehow caused the test scores of homeschoolers to be higher than XYZ, the point is that we have no causal evidence. And let me explain real briefly. Research that I have personally conducted and research by others shows no relationship, zero correlational relationship between the degree of state control regulation of homeschool students' learning across the nation, looking at all 50 states. And if you have your handout there, you'll see figures 1 and 2 talk about that. Figure 1 divides up the states into low, high, and medium regulation by the state over homeschooling, and you'll notice there's absolutely no difference, statistically speaking. The distribution of scores. So in other words, you have a state that requires testing or notification or permission on part of the, you know, parents getting from the state versus a state like Alaska now, where if you do not send your children to public schools, the public schools don't have them, essentially. No relationship to test scores. And so the importance of this is this. Research shows that there's not even a correlation evident in the data. There would at least need to be a correlation, that means just means a pattern, to even suggest a causative relationship. In other words, there is absolutely no evidence of a correlation, let alone a cause and effect relationship between state control of homeschooling and children's learning in homeschooling. I've been doing this basic research and publishing referee journals for about 19 years, and I know of no research that substantiates even a correlation, let alone a cause and effect relationship between state regulation, state control, including, for example, testing. It's not just testing, by the way. There are all kinds of ways that states try to regulate and control homeschooling. Furthermore, most interestingly, related to this proposed legislation, is that Dr. Jay Green shows, quote, academic achievement in public schools, this is fascinating, is positively correlated with educational freedom, end quote. One of the elements in his freedom variable is a regulatory environment for homeschooling. In other words, his research shows that the more educational freedom in a state, including less government control and regulation of homeschooling, the higher the academic achievement in public schools. So not only is there not a correlation between government control and homeschools learning, there's actually an inverse relationship, inverse relationship between control of homeschooling and public school academic achievement test scores. So the evidence is actually just the opposite, that reducing control over homeschooling will not only have maybe no effect on homeschool test scores, if we're talking about learning, but actually might increase the scores in public schools. It's kind of a fascinating concept, it has to do with choice. Professional standards of social science tell us that neither researchers nor policymakers nor legislators with no evidence of correlation, let alone causative relationships, should ever control important things in the lives of the citizens. It says that, in other words, research should present clear and compelling evidence of at least a correlation, and more definitely cause and effect, before policymakers use it to create or maintain regulations or law to control education or people's lives. And even if research shows correlation or causation, then ethics and philosophy must be also considered. Okay, let me skip on here. Oh, what's time do I have? 2 minutes. How am I doing? I need somebody to wave a flag at me. Okay. All things considered, especially since there's no positive or empirical research proof that control regulation by the government has ever significantly increased children's learning, it makes no sense to assume that such has been, is, or will ever be the case. In fact, due to the lack of correlational evidence, let alone cause and effect evidence, any person or group who promotes the maintenance of or increase of control regulation over home education bears a heavy burden of proof to verify that the state needs to continue to control and regulate home educators as it does now in Oregon. And I've testified to this on many courts across across the nation, and it's been accepted as solid evidence about control, regulation, and test scores. The more time the homeschool parents have to invest in their children's lives, for example, academics and other things, the more successful their children will be, and therefore the more society of Oregon is benefited. State control and regulation of homeschooling takes time away from the teaching and training of children, and it increases bureaucracy. This is bad for teaching and for learning. Very quickly, it's interesting, if you look at the Oregon Constitution, that all it says is that the state shall provide a uniform system of common schools. That's basically all there is in the Oregon Constitution. Oregon is to offer a state-run system to the public. The Constitution does not require all children to attend these schools. Look at Pierce versus Society of Sisters, Supreme Court case based out of Oregon, U.S. Supreme Court case. Furthermore, the Oregon Constitution neither requires nor authorizes the government to control nor to try to compel every child to be educated. Logically, it would be absurd to do so, since the government cannot guarantee that even in its own schools. It's a logical non sequitur to try to, in some way or shape or form, make sure the home-educated children are educated. Senate Bill 761 recognizes the primary and final authority of parents over the education and upbringing of their children. Some other states, as Senator Starr already mentioned here, already recognize this. For example, if the parents do not give their children over to the public schools for the education there, then the public school system does not need to be concerned about them. This bill, Senate Bill 761, strengthens the message that the government respects the dignity of parents by reducing government control of parents and families. It finally treats home education parents and their children with equity. I know that many people have lauded certain bills that have existed before this, but in reality, they have never been equitable. For example, the first Oregon homeschool bill and the current one are not exactly fair. For example, if a student in public schools fails, he is not required to attend private or homeschooling. It's never been the case, and in fact, the logic of it really missed many of us. In the first homeschool bill, when we said, you know, if you score below the 15th percentile, a child might be remanded to public or private school. It's never been the reverse. And in fact, if a third or half of public school children are, quote, failing by any measure, there is no provision to send them to homeschooling or private school. I've been a teacher and professor in private schools, public schools, and public private college universities, and a professor of education, as I mentioned earlier, at the undergraduate and graduate levels. Anyone who's taught in the public or private schools knows these schools, especially the public schools, have enough challenges and problems of their own. It's not about public schools. Public schools and the state need to continue spending their time and energy and the taxes of taxpayers on educational matters within the public schools. If the research were to be done, I would predict that we find the more control and oversight of home education by the government, the more the Oregon taxpayer has to spend on education. The government regulation control is expensive. Homeschoolers are not asking for taxpayers' money, nor control and regulation by the government. I know of many people in the state public school system who would rather just be left alone and not have to deal with homeschoolers anymore. I've talked to them recently, Clackamas County and elsewhere. In addition, the more homeschool students there are in Oregon, the lower the burden on the Oregon taxpayer. I personally estimated that the home education families in Oregon are saving their neighbors and fellow citizens at least $140 million this year. Just this year. The government does not need to control homeschooling as it does now. The government can spend more time and money on the citizens' public schools and students in them if it spends less time, taxes, and energy on regulating homeschool families. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 761.
Questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wright, thank you. I have just one question. I guess it is, how do you respond to the argument that I certainly heard surrounding this debate? And unfortunately, government's job sometimes is to deal in those thick streams, whether it's a criminal justice system or public health system. Mm-hmm. You have to deal, you make laws for not the norm cases, which I think the testing bears out. Mm-hmm. The norm is pretty remarkable. But in those extreme cases where now the state, it, through compulsory education laws, ensures that in this severe case, that at least that child who doesn't have independent judgment or choice is at least in some way through compulsory education, we have some mode to bring them back. And so in that extreme case, this law, if passed, would, I guess, break that bond that Oregon has traditionally held.
Well, Senator Deggett, I appreciate the question. And I would have to say respectfully, first of all, laws should not be made with a dragnet philosophy. In other words, if one out of 1,000 maybe aren't receiving an education that maybe they would in a public school, we will therefore have a law that controls the other 999. First of all, it's a philosophical question. Second of all, I sat next to a superintendent of public instruction in Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, last spring on a similar issue as she was testifying and I was testifying about a homeschool bureau there that was proposed to reduce the control of homeschooling. And it was fascinating as one of the representatives, it was the representative group, not the senators, asked her, how many years have you been watching and looking over the portfolios of homeschool students? It was something like 8 years, and I believe it was over 800 students, and they never found one that they would say needed to be put into the public schools to be improved. Now, this is not to say it doesn't exist, okay? I'm not arguing that no homeschool child ever is not well-educated. I'm not arguing that at all. But I believe the only answer is a philosophical one, and that is that first of all, like I mentioned, the state constitution does not give the state that responsibility. That I can read, it's very, very simple. It does not give the state that responsibility. It says, provide common schools. Number two, apparently, as somebody mentioned here earlier, that the state has trusted private schools now for well over 75 years. Mm-hmm. And the state of Oregon, of all states, tried to coerce people to attend private school or public schools. And back in 1925, the U.S. Supreme Court case said, no, you can't do that. It is not the responsibility. So the state of Oregon has trusted private schools and parents to put their children in private schools for now at least 78 years. And I think philosophically, you have to follow that analogy. You can't find every single individual who might not make it. And then, one more follow-up. Let's say you did find one who wasn't doing well, you didn't think the parents were doing well. If you put that child in public school, he would not necessarily do better. In fact, probabilistically, he would do worse, according to the research.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Decker,
thank you. Dr. Ray, you make, I think, many of the points you make are excellent. Mm-hmm. The one is I guess, and I'm not sure that this is convincing enough to vote nay on Senate Bill 761. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to look at the bulk of the evidence and mm-hmm. make a choice, but to me, you didn't answer the case of, I mean, and I think of the child, and
okay.
I would grant you 99.9, and I would grant you many of the statistics in terms of the public education system, mm-hmm. in terms of just empirical mm-hmm. homeschoolers or higher. But if you've got that one case in the child mm-hmm. who perhaps is in a situation, the laws we have today, and if they're in a private school setting, there's some way of they're in a community and monitoring mental mm-hmm. health. Mm-hmm. They're in and you can pick your extreme example where it's just not a healthy environment for that child. Mm-hmm. The laws we have today at least portend to say mm-hmm. we have some way of protecting that child.
Well, two things. One, the way I understand the bill, and I just read it again before I came in here, that is this. First of all, homeschoolers are in a community, like in private schools. May not be as tight. Actually, it might be tighter in some cases. Secondly, the bill does not say that nobody could ask a question, that nobody could challenge whether a child is getting educated, the way I read it. It just, one thing it does do, it shifts the burden to the state rather than the parent. In other words, the parent doesn't have to say, I have to prove to you I'm doing well. The state has to allege something and then say, now we're going to find out whether you're not doing it. And this is the way it is in many other states. So that's one thing. I don't think, as far as I read the bill, it does not cut the state out of asking the question or checking into the situation.
Thank you. Senator Moore,
One of the models, I think, of the homeschool system is in Lane County and the Bethel District, because the Bethel District has, I think, incorporated homeschooling with what the district has to offer in a different setting. In fact, I think they cover several school districts, mm-hmm. and homeschool parents can take advantage of that if they wish, and it's an opportunity for them to do some other kinds of things that they may not be able to do. As a teacher in the public school, I've had several in high school, one family who homeschooled all of their children through up through junior high, middle school. The kids all excelled. They were student body leaders. They were athletes. They were just great, great people. And the people that I do know personally who homeschool are exemplary, mm-hmm. and do a lot of volunteer work in the community, spend a lot of time at the library doing things. And I guess my question, though, refers to what Senator Decker might have been talking about, or it was talking about. Has the Supreme Court ever rendered a decision on the state, not just the state of Oregon, mm-hmm. but and the children within its jurisdiction?
The I mentioned Pierce versus Society of Sisters. That was 1925, related to court case in Oregon. And then Wisconsin versus Yoder, 1972. Those two are two of the closest you could get to, you know, homeschooling per se. And basically both of those said, although the state might believe it has some interest, the final decision-making authority rests with the parents. And numerous state courts have agreed that the authority lies with the parents, both primary and final authority. That's what I know so far.
I guess what I'm getting at, and I wish that I had the Supreme Court decision, but there was a case that the state, the United States Supreme Court, said that the state has a compelling interest in the children, that there is a compelling interest that children be educated. Now, they didn't say how.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, and I like to think it was a Utah case, but I know there was a Supreme, and I'm apologizing.
Yes, and I believe that has used that terminology in Supreme Court cases. However, the philosophic argument here is the burden of proof is on the state, not on the parents, just as in private schools. The state does not assume that the private schools have to prove a child's been educated. If you send your child to the local Catholic school or non-sectarian school, period. Now, if the state wants to say we're going to start regulating, controlling, asking you to test, so forth and so on, I have a hunch you'd be off to the Supreme Court pretty quickly for that kind of thing. And I understand the question. I've been asked the question numerous times, as you can guess, both in courts and the legislatures. But you have to take the paradigm shift that who has there's a law in logic called the law of non-contradistinction. It says you cannot be an elephant and not an elephant at the same time. In other words, you cannot say that the state has final authority or primary authority and that it does not at the same time. And so you by faith make a decision. In Oregon, are we going to believe in a sense of liberty and it's the citizens and the families first, or is it the state first? And that's kind of what that question comes down to. Will one in 1,000, will one in 10,000 maybe not get well educated? Maybe. But in public schools, it might be 10 in 1,000. And there's no remanding them to a private or home school.
Okay. If there is a report to services, to children and families, that a parent is keeping their child at home, not mistreating it, simply not teaching it, and that was a report by neighbors, and services to children and families went down to investigate, and they found that the child was not being mistreated in any way other than the fact that the child was given no education at all. There was no attempt to educate that child. Let's say even that the parents themselves were uneducated, and so the parents were incapable of educating the child. Would services of children and families have the authority, strictly on the grounds of education, to remove that child from the home?
I'm going to have to defer to somebody after me on the legal aspects of the law. Like I said, my understanding of it is that the state, let's just say, when I say state, I mean government, has the authority to check or ask questions. Now, again, the burden of proof would be on the state, not on the families. Right now, the burden of proof is consistently on the families, which, again, is not like in private schooling. But the way I understand it, there is some, there's the allowance for that. But I can't give you the line number.
Any questions? This we got a lot of people signed up, and we're in danger of losing a committee member. In fact, he's overstayed what he said he could. And Senator Deckard, I appreciate you staying. We have next signed up Marlene and Roger Williams, and Ann Larson Fisher. Please. Make your testimony briefly, succinctly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marlene Williams. I homeschooled through all 12 grades, and now I'm attending Western Baptist College here in Salem. As Dr. Ray has already said, homeschoolers have proven to do very well academically. But now, today, I'd like to tell you why I think the homeschooling process has helped me. As a class of one, I received one-on-one attention from my teachers. As my tutors, my parents were able to focus in on me and my needs, my strengths and weaknesses, not a classroom of 30 other kids. this tutoring method, or at least the availability of a tutor, allowed me to learn at my own rate and not be pressured or held back by other students' demands on my teacher's attention. The homeschooling process also allowed me to pursue my interests when I was interested. Because of this, I gained a much deeper understanding of the subjects than if I had been forced to take it when I didn't want to. As for the subjects I didn't enjoy that much, like math, my parents, as my tutors, knew my weaknesses and were able to encourage me. They didn't allow me to fall behind or avoid those difficult subjects. They kept me accountable to finish my work and live up to their standards, at least reasonable proficiency. As a result of their efforts, I feel that I got a well-rounded education. The homeschooling process that benefited me benefits other homeschool children as well, both with its built-in tutoring method and with its flexibility in allowing the children to pursue their interests when they want to. Thank you for your time. Any questions?
Thank you.
Ann, could you go next?
Okay. Senator Starr, members of the committee, I'm very happy to be here today. My name is Ann Larson Fisher. I am the mother of two adult children who are homeschooled in the Beaverton and Portland area. I've been active in the homeschooling movement for many years, and I've written two books on home education. You may know of my first book, Homeschooling in Oregon, which was published in 1994 and revised in 1998. I've just published my second homeschooling book, this time for a national audience, a book entitled Fundamentals of Homeschooling, Notes on Successful Family Living. The premise of this book is that homeschooling succeeds with such diverse families because homeschoolers are successful families. Indeed, those who are dissatisfied with their homeschooling education are remarkable by their scarcity. Now let me tell you how I came to write a book that equates successful homeschooling with successful family living. For years, I wondered about the wide diversity of successful families. I asked myself why. Why does homeschooling work so successfully with so many different families, all of whom use unique plans, materials, values, and theories of learning? That led to me to the how question. How do homeschooling families succeed so reliably, so independently, and so joyfully? In time, I realized I was seeking the underlying foundations of successful homeschooling. I gave up overlaying a school model of learning on families. I stopped looking at textbooks, curriculum, and methods. Instead, I began to observe the many families I met, and the answers I looked for became clear to me. I found the fundamentals of successful homeschooling deeply rooted in the familiar, the natural and age-old practices of successful families. In fact, most families are not even aware of how and why these practices build their success. They just do what works. I love to talk about those age-old practices, but I'm not going to. I use them as the section headings in my book, and they are play, conversation, togetherness, growing up, and exploring the world, things that we're all very familiar with from our own family life. I hope that gives you a tiny peek at the very big issues of the family basis of homeschooling success. However, no matter what habits they share, successful families remain widely diverse. No one would think of trying to standardize families. Clearly, homeschooling is individualized education, not standardized education. As such, homeschooling success cannot effectively be measured by standardized instruments, if it can be measured at all. I'll take a longer step and say that standardized testing is often very counterproductive to what we as parents are actually trying to achieve. It's far too easy for adults to underestimate the impact of testing on students, both short and long term. So just for a moment, let me remind us all of the inadvertent lessons that a student may learn as he faces tests. I have a list of 15 unintended lessons of standardized testing, and I'll read just a couple of them. My worth can be summarized by a single mark on a paper. Thinking is not valued. Getting the right answer is the only goal. My interests are not important enough to be measured. The purpose of learning is to get a high score. High test scores are the only purpose of testing. If I score well, I am better than other people who do not score as well. Poor test scores mean that I am a failure. If I score poorly, there is nothing I can do to change it. Why try? Please understand that standardized testing is potentially damaging to a most important goal of homeschooling, developing an enthusiastic love of learning that carries forward to adulthood.
I'll close by reminding you that children shine when they learn in a family setting. What was once an outrageous homeschooling experiment is now just an ordinary option. I urge you to move this bill forward with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pardon me, Roger Williams, on the board of Ocean Network. I've given you a graph here, and the graph shows from low scoring to high scoring, and it shows number of students that scored that particular score, and the 10% is by definition the average for each of that it should be, and that's what the public schools are. You'll notice that both and this follows on with Dr. Ray's data, that it doesn't matter whether you're in a low control, moderate, or high control state. You'll see that those are it's what I call the homeschool signature. There are very few students that score low, and there's a smooth curve up until a lot of homeschooled students score high. If you look at that, it's almost like there's a force pushing home-educated students towards academic excellence. And if you look at this and think of a container of ping pong balls, and there's a fan here that's blowing, that force will heap up the ping pong balls over here just exactly as you're seeing. And that's at all achievement levels. It's a smooth curve. What the current law does is it uses, and we're getting back to testing here, the current law uses testing as a mechanism to determine who to remand back to an institutional school. That's the purpose of testing in the current law. Low-scoring students. Oh, and I will say, you'll notice on the graph here that low-scoring students benefit from being educated at home just as much as the high-scoring students. And yet, the low-scoring students, are subject to remand, being sent, taken out of the home and put into an alien education environment. I'm particularly sensitive to that because my own son was right at the borderline for several years. He's now at the 15th percentile. He's now up to the 74th percentile in his 10th grade test. So he's turned it around. But this data it actually suggests that this force towards excellence, if a student is taken out and remanded, they will suffer because they don't have that force for excellence anymore. And by the way, if a student is taken out, their parent will have a disincentive. They'll think, oh, the state doesn't think I'm capable of educating my child, and that will lessen parental involvement wherever they go. The Department of Education, when I talked with them 4 years ago, said they do not track whether this was between the superintendent of, I was talking with the superintendent of public instruction, Stan Bunn, and Greg McMurdo, who at that point was the legislative guy for this, the Department of Ed. I asked them, do you track whether remanded students that have, over the past decade and a half have actually been hurt or helped when they were taken out of the home and put into an institutional school? They do not track that. So I'm going to be interested to see. I noticed that the Department of Ed is going to be testifying here. I'll be interested to see if they tie their stance on this bill to whether remanded children are actually hurt or harmed. So, questions?
Any questions?
Well, yes, if you don't mind. Thank you. Last session I introduced a bill that really kicked the homeschool people off, and which said,
Well, first of all, it was lowering the age to 12, but from 7 to 5 for mandatory education, which had nothing to do with homeschoolers. I had another bill that would require lesson plans submitted before they're and approved by the ESD to show that the people who said they were homeschoolers, who were giving you guys a bad name, that they would have to show some lesson plan or some evidence that they were really going to homeschool. And that died, that went down in flames. And so my question is, does it bother you that there are those people out there who are not, don't have any intention of homeschooling or simply look at homeschooling as a way out of meeting any obligation at all, and that there's no way to track them until 18 months after they've started the process? I mean, is that a concern, that there are people out there who are not legitimate homeschoolers?
Chair Starr and Senator Morris, I will respectfully defer a lot of that to Amy Grant. She's going to talk specifically to that point. But I will comment again on what Dr. Ray said, that the statute says if a child is being educated at home. And so the state, that is there. If the state wants to say no, you aren't, and wants to enforce the truancy law, that option is there. But I'm going to defer to Amy Grant on that. You and I have talked a lot about this, and I appreciate that question.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We've got a heavy schedule today, it looks like, and
send out the pizza.
We're going to stay here a while. I have let's see, I think we'll have Kevin Sterrett come up next.
For the record, Kevin Starrett. I will be uncharacteristically brief. Chairman Starr, members of the committee, I'd just like to address some of the concerns that some of you have had. And I'm a homeschooling father, and I can tell you that it's a tremendous commitment, and while it's very rewarding, it's a huge amount of work. And people who take on this commitment because of their concern for their children. And it gives us an opportunity to individualize their education in a way that you can't possibly test with a standardized test, because we don't have a standardized education. In response to Senator Farioli's concerns, I test my children every day, and I can tell you that the testing process doesn't necessarily reflect what they know. Senator Deckard expressed some understandable concerns about that one child who slipped through the cracks. And although this is probably not the most politically correct thing to say, Senator, that is going to happen. It's going to happen no matter what kind of educational system we have, and it happens all the time now in public schools. And the question then becomes is, who has the more compelling interest and the well-being of the children, the parents or the state? Obviously, I believe the parents do. As Senator Moore said, as far as your example about people who keep their children at home and simply don't educate them at all, but aren't neglecting them, frankly, I just find that concept to be very, very difficult to believe. Who would do that? Frankly, Senator Moore said it's a lot easier to get your kids out of the house than it is to keep them home. And so I don't know if there's an example of that you have, of parents who are otherwise not neglectful, who are taking care of their children, feeding them, keeping them healthy and clothed, and not educating them at all. It just sounds to me like a very unusual and not terribly believable situation. And so I could see you're really anxious to get it. But my point being simply that parents who are home educating have demonstrated over and over again their commitment to their children. They're giving them a tailored education, and they're doing things that couldn't possibly be done in a room with 30 other students. And if there are those examples of children who don't receive a perfect education for whatever reason, I just submit to you that that is no different from what's happening in almost every public school in the country.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Novick, and Cliff Rush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Novick, legislative liaison for the Department of Education. I'd just like to add on to some of the comments by Senator Deckard and Senator Morissette. The compulsory education laws, which every state in this nation has, and Oregon has had one since 1889, are designed to deal with the extreme cases. Most parents are responsible. The parents that are in this room are responsible parents. And if every parent was responsible and committed to their child's education, there'd be no need for compulsory education laws. In fact, if every person was responsible, there'd be no need for a whole mess of laws. But there are cases of folks who, as Senator Morissette has suggested, are not particularly committed to their children's education. I mean, one can imagine, I think, a family where the family business is to grow marijuana, and the only contact they have with the outside world is when they sell marijuana. And they don't want their kid to go to school because they think that the kid might let the other kids know that they're doing something illegal. But they're also not particularly interested in educating their kid. Under the current law, that if somebody finds out that kid exists, then at least every once in a while there will be a test of that kid to find out if that kid is actually being educated. The suggestion has been made that even if there is no test, the state could investigate and find out if a kid is being educated. I would submit that that would be much more intrusive than having the kid take a test. I don't think we want the school district sending people out to a homeschool kid's home every few days to see if they're really being educated. I think that'd be far more intrusive than what we have now. As far as the oversight we have of private schools, I don't know, maybe we should have more oversight, but what we do have is a law that says that the children who are exempt from compulsory education by virtue of being in a private school are exempt because they're being taught in a private or parochial school in the courses of study usually taught in grades 1 through 12 and are in attendance for a period equivalent to that retired of children attending public schools. That's 339.030A of Oregon revised statutes. So, and the state could walk into a private school and see, are they teaching kids just how to grow marijuana, or are they teaching the regular courses of study that are taught in the public school? So if there is no realistic mechanism for determining if kids are in fact being educated at home, there are going to be those extreme cases where kids simply are not being educated at all. The President of the United States has said, leave no child behind. The risk that we'd be taking if there's no oversight mechanism is that the children of extraordinarily irresponsible parents would be left behind. I'd also suggest to the committee that if this bill is passed, you'd be giving a deadly weapon to obnoxious teenagers arguing with their parents, because you've got, you know, people have teenagers that skip class and parents who sometimes aren't very good disciplinarians, and sometimes a frustrated parent will say, you know, I'm going to call the truant officer on you. And if this bill passes, those teenagers might say, oh, just tell them you're homeschooling me. And the parent will say, yeah, but you'll have to take that test, and they'll know that you're not learning anything. And the kid will say, nope, Senate Bill 761 passed. Wouldn't have to take any tests. You just have to tell them you're homeschooling me, and I'm home free. And I don't think you want to give those juveniles that argument, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much.
I guess I was going to try to offer my own explanation of the private. I went to a private school. Some of my children went to a private school. I went to a private high school, college, grade school, the whole bit. What does the state require of St. Paul's Catholic School in Eugene in terms of curriculum? I mean, the state must have some oversight over what they're doing at St. Paul's Catholic School.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, my understanding is that, in fact, what the state requires is what I just read to you under ORS 339-030, that the private or parochial school is teaching the courses of study usually caught in grades 1 through 12 in the public schools, and that the kids are in attendance for a period equivalent to that required of children among in public schools. And one might think that that's a fairly vague standard, and maybe it's something that the legislature might want to revisit. But it is at least a standard where you could theoretically, the state could walk into a private school and see if they, see what books are around and see if they are offering the courses of study normally offered in public school.
Any further questions?
Chair Starr, members of the committee, I'm Cliff Brush. I work at the Department of Education with alternative programs, homeschoolers, and private schools, and I'm sort of a contact point there. Since I started working with the homeschool folks, I've had about 110 contacts, either in person or by mail or by phone. Most of those folks are looking for ways to either find curriculum or assessments or ways to transition from or into public school, and I'm sure it might be possible that I've talked to some of the folks in this room, and the vast majority of them are doing apparently a wonderful job educating their students at home and keeping in mind the fact that they may be at some time transferring or transporting themselves back into the public system. In doing that work, I recently had a contact from Mickey Steele, who works for Polk County Human Services Department, Child Intervention Specialist. I believe you have a copy of her letter there. In part, she says that her concern is that there are families with various issues that are turning to homeschooling as an alternative to avoid attendance laws. Her theory is based on some actual cases that there are folks out there who are using homeschooling as the shield, as Mr. Novick talked about a minute ago, to say that they are no longer responsible for supervision of their children as defined in truancy and other laws because they're homeschooling. And her concern is that there's a rising tide of that she has just discovered a few cases of in Polk County. We can't say how many other than the ones that she reports here. She also describes a specific case of a child who is being confined more or less to the house to the detriment of the child's health, not just to the detriment of the child's education. I just bring that to your attention as one of those issues you want to contemplate as you consider homeschooling statutes.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think that a juvenile intervention specialist, they might rightly want to intervene in a case as extreme as these listed, but it would have nothing at all to do with this testing bill that we have before us, I think. So thank you very much, and we're going to have a couple more folks coming forward. I have Dorothy Carmen, and Christine Webb. We've still got another bill besides this one, folks. Please be brief with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have given you rather lengthy written testimony, and I will try to hit just the highlights of it. My testimony deals primarily with the constitutional issues involved with home education and home education freedom. As you know, Senate Bill 761 removes both notification and testing requirements for homeschooling, making homeschooling equitable with private education in Oregon. They are also in keeping with U.S. Supreme Court decisions regarding parental rights to direct their children's education. I provided a number of citations from Supreme Court rulings recognizing, quote, the rights of parents to establish a home, to bring up children, and to control the education of their own. That was from Meyer versus Nebraska. And the most recent citation regarding this parental rights issue was as recently as 2000. So this is not just an antiquated set of standards that the Supreme Court has. This is current standards. I want to take a moment to focus on one citation that's been mentioned before. It's Pierce versus Society of Sisters, which interestingly has Oregon connections. The history of Pierce versus Society of Sisters is that the Oregon public schools at the time were definitely and overtly Protestant. And Catholic schools had started up for families to choose to raise their children in Catholic, with Catholic education. The public schools, the state, tried to pass a law that would require all students to attend the public schools and disallow any parochial education. And the Supreme Court ruled in Pierce versus Society Sisters, the fundamental theory of liberty upon which all governments in this union repose excluded any general power of the state to standardize its children by forcing them to accept instruction from public teachers only. The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right and the high duty to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. Interestingly enough, I believe that since then the state of Oregon has not regulated private education, except as the gentleman from the Department of Education mentioned. I could start a private school in my home, invite other students to come, other children. I could teach them in my home. I would not have to tell anybody that I started a private school. The state couldn't come check on whether I was following the courses of study because they wouldn't know I exist. The parents who put their children in my private school do not have to tell anybody that their children are in a private school, and I don't have to test them. That is the current status of the most liberal private school rules in Oregon. Now, schools can choose to register, and there are registered private schools, and private schools can choose to be accredited, which is even a higher benchmark. But there are also many, many unregulated private schools in Oregon.
Excuse me. We're now at a subcommittee of the committee.
Okay.
Continue with your...
Thank you. Under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. That brings me to the second point. Doesn't the state have a compelling interest in the education of children, as you mentioned, Senator Morissette? Under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, a state can pass laws that impinge on a fundamental right only if there is compelling state interest to be served. And then the state must use the least restrictive method. That's the other half of that. There is compelling state interest, but they must use the least restrictive means possible in order to achieve the state interest. As I mentioned earlier, the state of Oregon has decided that the least restrictive means for private education is no regulation. Homeschoolers are asking for the same. In addition to that, the test scores that Dr. Ray spoke about demonstrate that homeschool students are well educated and that education provides a good method of ensuring that the state interests be met. Again, what about the No Child Left Behind that we heard mentioned by, I believe it was Senator, I'm not sure. The public policy enacted by Congress, No Child Left Behind, Congress made several exemptions to that, and you will find the complete exemptions in Appendix 2 of my handout. Both private and home schools are exempted. And just to highlight, nothing in this act shall be construed to affect a home school, nor shall any student schooled at home be required to participate in any assessment referenced in this act. So when they're talking about No Child Left Behind, they're talking about no governmentally funded schooled child is left behind. If the government is paying for the child's education, we're not going to leave them behind. And that's the goal. And again, Senator Morissette, you ask about parents who do not act responsibly. The U.S. Supreme Court maintained in Parnham versus J.R. that some parents may at times be acting against the interest of their children, creates a basis for caution. But it is hardly a reason to disregard wholesale those pages of human experience that teach that parents generally do act in the best interests of the child. The statist notion that governmental power should supersede parental authority in all cases because some parents abuse and neglect children is repugnant to American tradition. That clearly states that you don't need to cast the wide net in order to try to get at the exceptional cases. Irresponsible parents, as mentioned earlier, would much rather let someone else assume the responsibility for their children's education. Parents have to want to spend time with their children in order to contemplate home education. In summary, home educators in Oregon are asking this legislature to recognize that homeschools are not public schools by enacting Senate Bill 761. since the 1985 law was enacted, home educators in Oregon have demonstrated that home education works very well. This method of education more than meets the state's compelling interest in a child's education. Home educators would like equity with parents that choose private school. Home education freedom works. We urge you to please vote yes on Senate Bill 761.
Good afternoon, Chairman Starr, Senator Morissette. My name is Christine Webb. I'm the parent of three formerly homeschooled children. One was a National Merit Scholar. He's a second lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, serving his country as part of the 35th Fighter Wing in Misawa, Japan. One is a sophomore at the University of Oregon. The third is finished her first year at PCC. I'm a registered Democrat. I live near North Plains, Oregon. I am also the on the board of directors for the National Home Education Network. I currently oversee that organization's legislative clearinghouse, which is a service that provides information about legislative and legal issues that affect homeschoolers across the country. I'm speaking in support of SB 761. As a moderator for the legislative clearinghouse, I'm involved with homeschoolers, legislators, and activists across the country. I've watched as legislation affecting homeschoolers has been considered, debated, reconsidered, and voted on in state after state. There are a few significant trends that I believe will help inform your vote. First, there are many states, as suggested before, almost half, that have little or no substantive governmental oversight of homeschoolers. In some states, like California and Florida, homeschoolers are considered private school students. In other states, like Texas and New Jersey, the freedom comes as a result of court cases which have interpreted statute. In a few states, like Oklahoma, Illinois, and Indiana, there have never been any governmental oversight of homeschoolers. In all, 22 states fall into these categories where homeschooling parents are trusted with the oversight of their children's education free from governmental intervention. Second, there's a growing trend in states with more restrictive laws than Oregon's for legislatures to ease those restrictions. Montana and Alaska legislatures have chosen to deregulate homeschooling in the same way you're being asked to do so with Senate Bill 761. Michigan, New Mexico, and Nevada have all eliminated required standardized testing. There's legislation pending in Maine, where a bill to require only notification, which is a major reduction in oversight of homeschoolers, has received a unanimous ought-to-pass recommendation from that state's Joint Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. Yes.
Question.
Yes.
Did you distribute that?
I did. I gave it to her.
Did you?
It's three pages. It looks like this at the top.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm on the second page. Let's see where I was.
Well,
okay.
That's good. Good data.
Okay. Also, there's also a trend toward permitting homeschoolers greater access to public school programs. So, legislators in several states, including Oregon, have introduced legislation or considered introducing it, and then have kind of rethought their actions in light of information they receive from homeschoolers. As you can see, that trend is towards greater autonomy for homeschooling families at the state level. But what I really wanted to tell you was that it's not just the states that are making that decision. The federal government has also, we've talked about the No Child Left Behind legislation, where they specifically said homeschooling was not part of the required standardized testing. They specifically said they wanted homeschoolers left out of that. And since 1988, the Department of Defense has recognized a homeschool diploma with no testing, no outside verification, often prepared just by the parent and the child, to be equivalent to that of a high school diploma for enlistment purposes. So the military, as we found out in the case with my son, really is trusts parents to do that job and to decide whether or not, or decide how their children are doing and to assess their children. You've listened to testimony today that should convince you that this is the right thing to do from a variety of perspectives. I guess what I really want to say is that you wouldn't be forging new ground in this. You're not going out on a limb. This is definitely the trend across the country. And I'm hoping that you will make the decision to pass on SB 761. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have to ask this question.
Sure.
Yes. Maybe I missed this earlier. What happens if you want to go to the U of O and you have to have a 3.5?
Well, First of all, you don't have to have a 3.5 to go to the U of O. No, actually, my daughter is a sophomore at the University of Oregon. My son went to Rensselaer College, which is a private school. Neither one of them had a GED, a high school diploma, or my daughter didn't even have an SAT. She went to the community college and then transferred. My son... obviously, it was one of these great testers, and he went to on a full ride scholarship to Rensselaer. Generally speaking, across the country, we find this colleges are making all kinds of provisions for homeschoolers to be able to attend there. At the University of Oregon, you have to take an SAT, and you have to. And you may have to take an SAT too, which are subject area tests. They actually have a process for doing that has nothing to do with the state testing. There are no colleges where they look at this testing that is done at state level and do anything with that because it's not required in most states. Okay. Very few states require it.
Thank you very much. We've have two more people that want to testify. Amy Grant and Jeannie Bickerstaff. And, please be brief. We have another bill yet, and we have people here that have to leave. We will not be acting on the bill because we're in a subcommittee of the Senate Education Committee. We'll have to bring this back for a work session at a later time. Thank you.
Senator Starr and members of the committee, my name is Amy Grant. I'm the president of the Oregon Home Education Network as well as a member of the Oregon and California State Bars. I'd like to focus my testimony on the question of truancy and these extreme cases that have been brought up. First of all, educational neglect is a form of child neglect. That is a form of child abuse. It is covered by the current state laws and rules and mandatory reporting. In fact, less than 20% of cases of child abuse and child neglect nationally are reported by education education officials. All the rest are reported by community members, by families, by neighbors. So there is a system already in place to address the family that's raising marijuana. There is a system already in place to address the family that's confining a child. That is abuse. This bill has nothing to do with that. This bill relates to testing, to standardized testing. If we want to talk about these extreme cases, they just don't happen in a vacuum. They happen in a context of chemical dependency, of mental illness, you know, in a context of a very dysfunctional family. We have mechanisms in place. The state can go in and should go in if there is a child being neglected. I disagree that the Services for Children and Families is going to go in every 3 days and ask homeschooling families. They're only going to go in if there is a report, and they have mechanisms in place to determine the validity of the report and whether the report deserves attention. So I would suggest that for those extreme cases, we already have a system. It has nothing to do with registration and testing. It has to do with child neglect. The other issue I wanted to bring up was the issue of the compelling state interest. I think Dorothy Carmen really addressed it. The state does have a compelling state interest in the welfare of children. The U.S. Supreme Court has also stated in numerous cases that the parents' right to direct the child's education is part of their fundamental right of privacy. As a fundamental right, it puts a high burden on the state to establish that that compelling interest exists and is being met by the most restrictive means, the means that least infringe upon the parents' rights. And the way that the state is currently addressing private schools is to say that you will teach the courses of study and you will have the same attendance. I would suggest that we have the attendance. We teach the courses of study. We probably don't teach it in many cases in the same order that it's taught.
If my daughter were to take the standardized test for second grade, she should be tested on ancient Egypt because that's what she took a passion on. My son, when he was six, was explaining to me how mirrors can be used to direct the flow of a laser. That's not on the standardized test. So, yes, the state has an interest in the welfare of children. It has already determined that that can be met by a law that says children will be taught a course of study over K through 12 and that they will be in attendance. Homeschoolers are in attendance and homeschoolers are teaching their children. Their children are learning in a broad spectrum. I'd like to make one last point about lesson studies, I know that you're concerned, Senator Morissette, about truancy and the bill that you introduced last session to require that parents provide lesson plans. I can tell you that I would not be able to provide a lesson plan because my education of my children depends on their needs and that those needs change over time.
Yeah, may I clarify? I'm only saying that when they start to homeschool as a sign that they're really serious about being homeschoolers and not just saying, oh, I'm going to homeschool my child and come back in 18 months and test. That's the only reference I mean to make to lesson plans, just to show up front that they're serious.
I understand, Senator Morissette, that you're really concerned about truancy and you're concerned about children that may be claiming to be homeschooled but may not be getting the parental support that they need. And primarily truancy is an issue for the public schools. I mean, I understand that that is an issue. It's an economic issue. It's a child welfare issue. This bill has nothing to do with truancy. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Chairman Starr, Senator Morissette, for the record, my name is Jean Biggerstaff. I serve on the board of the Oregon Home Education Network. I'm also a homeschooling parent of a 14-year-old son who I've homeschooled from the beginning. I really don't have much to add. I just want to say one thing that came up earlier. There was a lot of emphasis on testing, and unfortunately, Senator Farioli is not here, but he made the comment that homeschoolers rose to the occasion by scoring well on tests and that they scored well on tests because they were required to, he implied that they did well because they were required to take tests. The evidence really doesn't support that. Children don't score well on tests because they're required to take them. They score well on tests because they have an opportunity to be learning in an environment that's supportive of the way they learn. And the tests are actually not an indicator of success in life. And I think there are many studies that show that people who do really well on tests don't necessarily turn out to be CEOs of companies. Success in life isn't meted out in little test scores, and I think that's a really important thing. The other thing I'd like to say, that because testing seems to be, it's something easy that we can grab onto, and it's an easy thing to see, to say, oh, well, this child is doing well. But if close state oversight and involvement of certified teachers and mandatory testing were the answer to effective education for all children, we would have a 100% graduation rate in any school we have, private, public, or anything. Close oversight, test scores don't guarantee educational success. Parental involvement and direct involvement of the children in choosing how they learn is what makes successful students. I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your attention here today. This is an important bill for all of you, I'm sure, and we'll be bringing it back for a work session. First time we can get a forum together, maybe as early as Tuesday. So, with that, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 761 and opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 490. And is Representative Bates in the hall?
Or is calling?
Susan King. David Parent. Parent. Harry Waldrop. Yes, please. Go ahead and introduce yourself and let us have your testimony.
Good evening, Senator Starr and Senator Morissette. My name is Susan King. I'm representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm just here to point out a couple of issues with respect to Senate Bill 490. First of all, I know it's a moot point at this point, but we would request that you not move this bill today. The two sections really address two separate issues. The first section, which deals with a program that has been in place for a number of years, which is called the Nursing Services Program. For years, it was limited to those nurses who go and practice in a rural area and then repay student loans by that practice. Last legislative session, we introduced a bill to broaden the loan repayment program to include critical practice shortage areas. And from the inception, the long-term care practice has been included in the priority areas. So Section 1 is already being done through the work of the Office of Rural Health and the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Section 1 is also certainly a fine provision. Section 2, however, appears to me to be an earlier version of what Senate Bill 800 eventually became, and earlier in this hearing, the first bill that you heard today was Senate Bill 800, which was, as you know, supported by many, many organizations. This language is a much shorter version of the earlier LC draft that became Senate Bill 800. So if your desire is to pass Senate Bill 490 at some point, we would request that Section 2 be eliminated from the bill because it really would be in conflict with Senate Bill 800 that you just passed.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, my name is Terry Waldrop, and I am co-chair of the Governor's Task Force on the Future of Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'm also CEO of Farmington Centers, and Farmington Centers owns and operates assisted living, residential care, and nursing facilities in the state of Oregon. One of the overarching recommendations of the Governor's Task Force, there were eight original overarching recommendations, and one of those was is basically addressed by Senate Bill 800. The second section of Senate Bill 800, which is increasing the system capacity by developing the acute and long-term care workforce. It is true that the rules, there are currently rules in place that address the first section of Senate Bill 490, but they're not in statute. And what the Governor's Task Force really emphasized was that we need to better address and provide services for the long-term care industry. And one of those critical areas that we need to provide increased services for is nursing. There's a critical shortage. So the first section of Senate Bill 490 would really address putting into statute the fact that it would make, on behalf of nurses who practice in critical shortage areas, it would put that into statute. It's true that the rules exist, but it would more formalize in the fact that there's a critical shortage on an ongoing basis. So I might recommend that we might amend Senate Bill 490 because Senate Bill 800 addresses the second section quite well, but keep the first section in of Senate Bill 490.
Thank you very much. Representative Bates has joined us. Would you like to come forward and testify on this bill, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a 6:30 appointment with the Oregon Medical Association to take a few bolts in the chest on another bill, so I appreciate having a chance to talk. Thank you, Susan.
For the record, I'm Representative Alan Bates from Ashland, and I've been asked to testify on Senate Bill 490. I had the pleasure of serving on the Senior Task Force in the last interim, and this bill is a direct result of that task force, amongst other bills you'll be seeing. I was going to make some comments about the shortage of nursing instructors. My understanding is that is in another bill, and this may well be deleted from this bill, so I'm not going to speak to that at this time. What I would like to do is give a little insight about the type of nursing situation we're talking about here from a physician's point of view and my point of view as a legislator. First off, we all know that we have a huge wave of senior citizens coming at us very quickly here in the next 10 years, and that the growth of that population is going to be, the fastest part of that population growing is going to be in people over 85 years of age, and many of them will be in the 90-year age group. Those people, unfortunately, while they're healthier than they've ever been before, any age we can imagine, are also going to be needing more care. And a lot of that care is going to occur in extended care facilities, and it'll be prolonged care. I would also tell you that the nurses, the RNs who give that care, do not have the most glamorous job in medicine. This isn't the ICU. This isn't the emergency room. This isn't the ER you see on TV once a week. This is really difficult care. We have people who have problems with dementia, people who have problems with bed sores and incontinence, people who are going to be there for a long time with some very chronic and difficult problems, and the nursing care they receive there, while it may not be glamorous, is actually vital to their quality of life and their ability to survive. A lot of those people also will be going through those extended care facilities as they come out of hospitals and require care for fractured hips on recovery and other issues of that nature that you see more and more in extended care facilities. This is an area which I believe is very hard to recruit nurses for. It's a situation where a nurse will commonly come out of school, go into an extended care facility, and when something else becomes available for he or she, moves on to another part of medicine. So I think it's very important we look at this as a shortage area, just as we look at rural areas as a shortage area also. And I would ask you to consider it on that basis, that this bill is one that's appropriate and necessary as a part of the of what we're trying to do to resolve our nursing shortage. And I'd be glad to take any questions you might have.
Yes, sir.
And only one question. No. Would you feel, Representative Bates and Dr. Bates, both of you?
We are schizophrenic. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette.
Would you feel more comfortable if this language was statutorial rather than a rule?
Yes. I would rather see it statutorial than a rule. I think the way it's going here is the best way to go.
Okay. And I guess this is not a question, but a statement, but I am nervous about administrative rules. I had a meeting with LIPA and the health department today and OMAP and so on, and dealing with administrative rules that go here and there and everywhere, and they can change.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I couldn't agree more. I like this being in statute. It's straightforward. It's clear. Precise. I like it. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Dr. Bates, I have a comment. This is very personal to me because day before yesterday I was notified that my father has congestive heart failure and pneumonia and is in a nursing home where they said that they could watch him die or they could move him to the hospital where they could aggressively treat him. We asked Dad what he wanted, and he said he wanted to be aggressively treated. And so he's now in the hospital and doing better.
Good.
92 years of age, and we're very thankful for the care that he's received. Yes, please.
Thank you. My name is David Parrott. I'm the executive director, and I appreciate Senator Starr and Senator Morissette for coming to you tonight. I'd like to certainly second the comments that were made by Representative Bates. I think that as we look to the future, we know that care in extended care in nursing homes and retirement are going to be important, and certainly we're also looking at a shortage of nursing that we have now, and it will grow. As the director of a retirement community and also nursing home, I can see and tell you firsthand the issues and the concerns we have about a shortage of nursing. And I won't go into a lot of detail about that. I think we're all aware that there's a shortage of nursing, and I would like to lend my support to Senate Bill 490. And again, I think with the caveat, I would agree that we could amend Section 2 from that bill, but I do believe the section, or Senate Bill 490 should pass, and I think that we need to do everything we can to help support and to give opportunities for nurses to seek opportunity or seek employment in long-term care and assist them along the way.
Thank you very much. Anyone else care to testify? Oh, yes.
At the risk of running long, Brian DeLeisman, Oregon Nurses Association, I just wanted to do a little clarification because actually I was in on the original design of the original program, and then I was in on the design of the expansion, so it wasn't just the rural program, it was by practice to be included. And I just want to clarify that we're not really talking about administrative rules. The administrative rules that are promulgated around this bill do not specify one type of practice or another. What it's set up to do is to say, as the demand for different types of practices shifts back from long-term care to ICU to CCU, that it has the flexibility for the participants that set and take the applications to make a judgment at that point, what is the top priority during that period of time. And long-term care was one of the two priorities that is currently in existence. So I guess I would tell you that the system, the way it's currently designed and was redesigned last legislative session, in fact, is already working, and long-term care was designated as one of the top two, home health being the other. We know there's a shortage of cross-nursing, but there was a recognition by all the participants that long-term care was one of the top two. So to put long-term care specifically in the statute would cause a situation in the future that if long-term care's needs were taken care of, then do you come back and you add a clause that says, well, now we have a problem in CCU or ICU or in home health or something else, and we put them specifically in the statute. So I just wanted to give you a little history. The reason why it's designed the way it is right now is it can respond to the specific shortages by the type of nursing as we go along. And that's why you have a group that gets together and says, okay, where's the problem? And how can we direct folks into that? So that's what we have as a program now, and it's actually working very well. And long-term care was one of the priorities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming forward to testify. Add to our enlightenment. We're going to close the public hearing and adjourn the Education Committee.